That's to say that I hate being on the internet even more than I normally do right now.
Well, Ross, we'll probably catch it from all sides. People will say, oh, Ross, you're the left's favorite conservative.
Yeah.
The radical left's favorite conservative is what I have in my bio.
Well, Samuel, should we get started?
Let's do it.
Okay, welcome to episode 14 of Know Your Enemy. It's a special episode. This was our first conservative guest, and it shouldn't be any surprise to you that it was none other than New York Times columnist Ross Douthat.
That's right.
And just for promotional purposes, the author of the forthcoming book, The Decadent Society, How We Became the Victims of Our Own Success. And in this conversation, which, well, I should add that it was a conversation and not an interrogation or a debate or, yeah, some showdown where we tried to win an argument with Ross. It was a conversation, and we talk about how he sees what's going on the right now, and also the book I just mentioned, The Decadent Society, and that kind of comes in the second half of our conversation. But Sam, what did you make of our chat with Ross?
I think that the idea of having real live conservatives on the podcast is something that we have wanted to do and talked about doing, and that in many ways Ross was a good first case, a test of how that would play out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in part because he's really game and understands to some degree what we're trying to do and does write to a liberal and left audience at the New York Times a lot. So mm-hmm. is like sort of conversant in the ways in which these like discourses of the left and right overlap, and that listeners will not be surprised that like our approach was not to try to like catch him at his worst moments. And
right. Well, I think what I said to you, Sam, off air, was that my goal was, I find Ross to be a genuinely interesting thinker and writer. And so my goal was to more elicit his views on things that I myself am thinking through, like the new nationalism on the right, like mm-hmm. kind of how Trump fits into the history of conservatism, those kinds of questions, rather than, again, play the game of gotcha with him or, you know, dive in on a specific topic and debate him about it.
And I think, like, look, the purpose of this podcast is not like winning a debate with the right so much as it is trying to understand really what's going on here and what the ideas really are and what the motivations of our political opponents are. And I think would be very foolish of us to not take advantage of an opportunity right. like interviewing Ross Douthat for that purpose.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I have to say, too, I really like Ross. He's just a very nice guy. And
yeah, it's annoying how nice he is.
Right. Totally. I get what you mean. But I also think, I think partly what makes him interesting is because he's not just a mainstream liberal himself. I think he has a genuine interest in the left. And the debates happening on the left, broadly conceived, and he's interested in Bernie Sanders, as we've talked about before on one of those bonus episodes. You know, he's written a number of columns very favorable to Bernie. So I think Ross is, I enjoy talking to him in part because he is a nice guy and very intelligent, but I also feel like there's a way in which he speaks, he's able to like move between vocabularies and kind of talk to the left, I think, in language the left can understand.
Yeah.
Precisely because he himself has views that are a bit out of the mainstream and I think likes other people who are just, you know, not quite self-satisfied New York Times style liberals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that if we had conducted this interview in a way that felt like a trap to him, that first of all would have been, you know, pretty rude and inconsiderate to his time, but also that we wouldn't get to do this kind of thing again. You know,
yeah.
I think that like it's definitely in keeping with the ethos of the podcast to create like a space where this kind of dialogue can happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without ever kind of compromising what our like fundamental principles are, which I don't think we do and or have.
Right.
So I thought it was really good. I think it's a really interesting conversation. I think people, that the listeners will enjoy it. And of course, like, you know, if you hate it, then, you know, tweet about it and, you know, so let's have a dialogue about it, because, I think it's interesting. I think we achieved a productive conversation, and, you know, you can be the judge.
I think so. And I'm excited for everyone to listen to it. Before we share that conversation, just a few housekeeping items. One, part of the reason Ross came on was he has a book coming out in February. And another thing is that this conversation, a transcript of it, I think will be in the spring issue of Dissent, the issues focusing on the future of the right. And so one reason, when we pitched Ross to come on the show, we also told him that this interview would be in Dissent at some point. So that's a great reminder that Dissent is now sponsoring the podcast, and it's been fun working with them, not just on the podcast, but also in, you know, conversations about what the spring issue will look like. And so, yeah, thank you to them as always. And as a reminder, if you support us on Patreon at the $10 a month or more level, you get a free digital subscription to Dissent.
That's right. Yeah. And if you support us at even the $5 a month level, then you'll get access to my and Matt's freaking out about the Democratic primary episodes, Patreon episodes, which we are carefully avoiding doing right now in this introduction. But
yes,
the rank punditry episodes are available to those of you who are interested in it. And
yeah, and we're going to do more of them.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have no choice.
No, we did. That was one of our goals in the new year, was a lot of you have been very generous in supporting us. And we really wanted you to feel like, you know, if you're supporting us in that way, that you're getting all kinds of bonus episodes and that you're being well taken care of by us. So that's what we're going to do. More bonus episodes, even if they are rather Sam and I descending to the lowly level of the pundit. The electoral politics pundit. But people seem to like it. And
yeah,
we've been encouraged to do, you know, the rank punditry episodes. But we also do stuff like the last one we did was on Christopher Hitchens. And that wasn't really punditry.
No.
Exactly. It wasn't just talking about politics. It was something else. So we'll do things like that too from time to time. But anyways, that's all to just say thank you for the support. Please do support us. If you aren't, please consider it at least. And that for those of you who do, again, more bonus episodes are in the pipeline.
Yeah, just think of it as a chance for us to let our hair down and really get down and dirty in the discourse. If you like that part of the podcast.
If you don't mind Sam and I having a cocktail while we do it.
Though frankly, I should probably have fewer cocktails than I had in the last bonus episode.
It happens to the best of us. But, you know, I think having something to just kind of steady the nerves.
It was an episode on Christopher Hitchens, so appropriately enough, I had too much whiskey to drink.
Yeah. Well, anything else, Samuel?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Well, let us know what you think of this. We're excited to share it with you, our conversation with Ross Douthat. All right. Well, welcome to Know Your Enemy, Ross Douthat.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be. I guess I'm the first real life enemy that you've had on. That's a privilege.
At last, an enemy.
Yeah. In the interest of fairness and balance, we wanted to have a real life conservative on. But we're really glad you're going to be that person for us. And
well, it's good. I mean, you need to work your way up, right? Like you start and then eventually you'll have Sean Hannity, right? I mean, I'm like a gateway drug to Fox primetime.
I was thinking like a series of boss fights in a video game. You're the first one.
I'm the easy boss.
Yeah.
No, that's what I'm here for.
Right. Well, I thought to begin with, Ross, why do you call yourself a conservative?
We're just going to jump right in.
Yeah.
I mean, I call myself a conservative first because I have I think, fundamental political commitments that broadly align with the political right in the United States, in the sense that my primary commitments are what gets called religious conservatism, which, you know, I think is a fair description of the sort of pro-life, pro-family, socially conservative worldview. And it's a worldview, you know, anyone who reads my writing probably notices that I have some more sympathies with sometimes the center left and sometimes the left on economics than some conservatives do. But that those primary commitments, I think, are generally pretty unwelcome on the left of center and in what gets called liberalism. And so, I mean, that's sort of the basic, you know, if you think of politics along coalitional lines, friend enemy lines, if we can get Schmidtian so early in the podcast. That's sort of the core reason. And then the sort of secondary reasons are, I think I have a sort of personal, you know, a sort of personal conservatism that manifests itself in aesthetic affinities. You know, I like the past. I find the past interesting. That's sort of the personal psychological side of it. And then, you know, I don't really like, I like liberals. Like, a lot of my friends are liberals, many of my friends probably, but I don't really like liberalism as a worldview overall. It has its, advantages. It's not the worst worldview ever constructed, but I basically disagree with it on a lot of levels. And so, I mean, I think a lot of, I think it is a reality that, you know, something that can reasonably be called liberalism is the sort of defining ideology of most educated people, most people who write for a living in the Western world. And then people who, for one reason or another, aren't liberals, unless they're Marxists, get placed on the right. And so, you know, do I have a ton in common with the worldview of, say, you know, some of the people who write for Quillette, right? Some of the sort of intellectual dark web people, not necessarily. But I think it's okay to say they're on the right and I'm on the right. Because we're all sort of defined against an existing consensus of sorts.
It's Schmidt's world. We're just living in it.
I'm not going all the way to Schmidt until minute 35 of this discussion.
Well, then, Russ, how might you situate yourself? You actually used the word consensus, and of course, one of the more provocative and famous manifestos of the last couple of years was the First Things piece against the dead consensus, signed by people like Patrick Deneen and Matt Schmitz and Sobe Amari and Rod Dreher. Sorry, I almost slipped you in there.
I don't sign manifesto unless I write them myself.
And so, since you've claimed the moniker conservative, given everything that's going on the right, how do you situate yourself in the midst of whether you want to call it post-liberalism, illiberalism, the new nationalism, the constellation of things percolating on the right now? How do you situate yourself within that constellation, or maybe even just what do you make of these developments? And we can talk about all these things in more depth too as we go.
Sure. So I mean, I've been in a way against the dead consensus since before it was dead.
Right.
I'm not actually sure it's dead, but you know, the first major thing I ever wrote or co-wrote about public policy was a long essay that became a book. Almost, the essay was 15 years ago now, and the book was 12 years ago. The book was called Grand New Party, and it was basically an argument for, you know, a more working class friendly American conservatism that was rooted more in social conservatism than in libertarianism. And to the extent that that has sort of emerged as one of the ideological responses to the Trump era, it's sort of where I've been all along. I think the sort of policy stuff in it has shifted a bit. You know, I think if I went back now and reread my own writing from the 2000s, which is always a mistake, I don't recommend it. You know, there's less, like, things that loom larger now, like the China shock and so on, mm-hmm. had not really sort of made themselves felt. We didn't write a lot about trade in Grand New Party. We were mostly focused on family policy and, you know, sort of wage stagnation and stuff like that. And we were also more optimistic. The book sort of ends on a little bit of an optimistic note. We were optimistic about the internet, which mm-hmm. I'm not really optimistic about anymore. Uh-huh. But still, but you know, with those caveats, that was basically my view then. And it's basically my view now. I think that sort of something that is sort of would get labeled populism, mm-hmm. something that is sort of a moderately socially conservative politics that tries to do more for the working class has sort of always been my politics since I've been an adult. Mm-hmm. I think where I differ, not from all the signatories to that letter, but some of them, is that I'm more Trump skeptical than mm-hmm. some of the sort of people in this populist nationalist orbit. You know, Trump is sort of like, to me, he's sort of the monkey's paw answer to Grand New Party. Mm-hmm. It's like you wish for the populist nationalist conservatism and you get Trump. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, you know, I'm anti-Trump. I'm not as anti-Trump as sort of the, you know, the sort of Max Boot wing of the Never Trump movement. Mm-hmm. But I'm not for Trump. And I think that the critique of him as, you know, one, a racist, and two, an incompetent is a pretty reasonable critique. And I think the Trump era offers clear opportunities to the kind of politics that I guess I believe in, but I don't think they can be claimed simply by throwing in with Trump, especially for sort of people who write about policy. You know, the position of a politician is a little different mm-hmm. and a little more complicated, but those of us who have the luxury, you know, that we get to keep our jobs, even if we, you know, attack Trump a lot,
yeah.
I think should attack Trump more than some people in the nationalist world or the populist world do.
Right. Yeah, that's something actually that I've noticed in your writing over the past few years is that you're obviously a really lucid observer of these new developments on the right.
You're so kind. Yeah.
This is Sam again.
You're just softening me up, right?
I am, for the kill. But mm-hmm. no, I was going to say that it seems like often in your writings about whether it's the post-liberalism, the national conservatism, these new iterations of pseudo populist nationalist correctives to a certain kind of the dead consensus or American exceptionalism or whatever, that often Trump poses a problem for you in a way that it doesn't for the partisans of these movements. You know, whereas they see Trump as an avatar of, they sometimes see Trump as an avatar, if an imperfect avatar of the project. In a few of your columns, I've seen you say, well, this stuff sounds good. The problem is Trump.
Yeah, I think I wrote a column after the big national conservatism conference where I said, you know, there were a lot. I mean, it was a big conference, and obviously there were people who spoke there with whom I did not fully agree. Yeah. But there were a lot of speeches given there that I would, you know, broadly be sympathetic to. But I felt like that conference sort of occupied this zone in between punditry, which has the luxury of being anti-Trump, and sort of the politicians who have to deal with him. But that zone meant that, you know, it wasn't just sort of kowtowing to Trump, but it didn't know, it sort of avoided dealing with him in a certain way. And that's, yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of, that's a problem. And maybe it's a problem that goes away if Trump is just defeated and we get into a world where, you know, we're sort of arguing about who the next political standard bearer for conservatism should be or what the next ideological nerve center should be. But as long as Trump is president, he's, you know, he's the public leader of whatever the American right is. And, you know, I mean, the underlying reality here is just that I my moral objection to Trump and my strategic objection to Trump are the same, in the sense that I think that, you know, the thing that is most, you know, morally bad about Trump is just basically going back to his decision to start his sort of ascent as a birther, that he's, you know, he's a race baiter, basically.
Yeah.
And the strategic problem with Trumpism is that you need, in the United States, if you're going to build a sort of populist center-right coalition that is culturally conservative and is willing to lose some of the suburban moderates, you know, whatever we want to call them, that voted for Hillary in 2016, you need Black and Brown Americans in that coalition.
Right.
And I think Trump has done less to destroy that possibility in certain ways than some people think, in the sense that the Republican Party was already pretty incompetent at doing minority outreach. And, you know, his vote share with Hispanics and African Americans wasn't right. any worse than Romney. So I don't think Trump is like the, you know, the permanent surrender to white identity politics from which there is no return. But I think he does most of the time represent white identity politics in a way that sort of does prevent this sort of would be populist coalition from, you know, both being non-race baiting or non-racially divisive, and from actually commanding more than 42 to 46% of the country.
Yeah. Well, one thing, this might be a good way of asking how you view Trump in terms of continuity and discontinuity with what came before him. And I know you've written about this some in your columns, but, you know, there's a way of looking at the post-war American right, the rise of the conservative movement. And, you know, you locate race much more centrally to it. You say, oh, the talk about welfare reform, dependency, crime, these were all race-inflected issues in some sense. And the right has kind of been powered by this white majority that's slowly shrinking. And Trump is kind of, I don't want to say a last gasp of that, because it's not clear that that will be the case. But you see Trump as essentially being in continuity with the racial preoccupations, racial backlash of the right for the last 40 or 50 years. And it's just as that majority has dwindled, it's become more virulent, and kind of the worst elements of it have risen to the fore. And Trump represents that, rather than being a break with what we've known as conservatism. And I just wondered how you would kind of view that story of where Trump came from, that he's kind of riding some of the same energies that have propelled conservatism forward for a while, and what you sort of make of that account of Trump, and where you might disagree.
So, I mean, there are always both continuities and discontinuities,
sure.
Right? Uh-huh. And, you know, conservatism, any political coalition in a country of now 300 million people is going to always sort of contain within itself a lot of different tendencies that
sure.
can rise to the fore, sometimes for contingent reasons. You know, there are worlds in which things broke slightly differently and Trump wasn't the Republican nominee and people said, oh, you know, he was just the last gasp of something that never commanded more than 25% support, which is what I kept saying about him, which didn't turn out to be true.
Oops.
I think that if you look at it, certainly what Trump, one thing that Trump represents is a kind of secular, non-Southern form of conservatism that was pretty important in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And seem to have sort of gone away because the issue matrix around it had gone away, right? I mean, there's a reason that Trump is from New York. There's a reason that Rudy Giuliani is his sort of, you know, his number one guy at this point,
sure.
right? Uh-huh. You know, the whole sort of this part of Fox News that's like sort of outer borough right of center politics, if you will,
yeah.
mm-hmm. Was something that was really important in American politics when crime and urban policy were these huge zones of debate.
Yeah.
And then it sort of stopped being important because the crime rate went down and welfare was reformed. And, you know, the cities seemed to sort of recover from whatever happened to them in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And so if you get to, you know, if you look at the Republican Party of the early 1990s, you can totally see where Trump comes from. Right. If you look at the Republican Party of the early 2000s, when I first started writing, it seems like it's a, you know, mostly sort of, you know, sort of Southern rooted religious conservative party that, you know, that is sort of trying to escape some of those race and crime debates.
Right.
And then you sort of cycled back to this, and Trump has sort of put together a lot of different pieces, right? It's sort of there's the revival of Giulianism in certain ways, yeah, without, you know, without the sort of policy stuff that, you mm-hmm. know, Giuliani actually did have as mayor. There's this sort of shift in religious conservative politics from sort of confidence and optimism to pessimism and fear that has sort of made a bargain with Trump seem more plausible than it would have 15 years ago. But then there's also further complexities, right? Like Trump has also activated a portion of religious conservatism that you could call, you know, the sort of mix of Christian nationalism and prosperity theology mm-hmm. that has always been there. And, you know, sort of surged in the 80s in certain ways with the televangelists and sort of seemed to similarly have gone into abeyance as a cultural force. But then, you know, the right sort of figure and constellation of forces can make it come back. So things have, I mean, one of the things that makes Trump so fascinating to write about is that, you can connect him to all kinds of yeah. different trends and tendencies all at mm-hmm. once. I think on the race issue, you know, my basic take, and I think I wrote a column saying this, is that the way that you sort of escape racially polarized politics and race baiting politicians is to try and figure out what the substantive policy issue is that's connected to racial animosity and racial anxiety and try to solve it.
Yeah.
And it's that, and that is hard, but it's easier than imagining that you know, just the right rhetoric can deal with racial animosity. And so
I would say we agree with you there.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I think we would disagree on the, you know, the sort of story of the 70s through the 1990s. I see that as a story of a total failure of liberal governance around crime and urban policy.
Yeah.
That was inevitably going to provoke a backlash. Mm-hmm. And the way you dealt with the backlash was by doing, you know, some version of what we actually did, which was sort of changing welfare policy and
mass incarceration.
And right. Well, and mass incarceration is sort of the tourniquet that then you, once the crime rate starts to go down, you try and take it off, which is, you know, something that I think, to their credit, a lot of religious conservatives had been involved in. It is, I mean, this is, again, the sort of paradoxes and tensions, right? Is
yeah.
That's the one policy deal that Trump actually made was on criminal justice reform in spite of his race baiting.
Right. In spite of what you're saying, which I think is really astute, and I hadn't even really put this together, which is that there is such a, he is very comfortable in that space of the Giuliani-esque outer borough conservative of the 80s and 90s. Like, you know, when he you can really feel that he's in his stride when he's talking about like Elijah Cummings' district or Nancy Pelosi's district and like the liberal cities overrun by like yep. poor people and homeless people and crime. He really is comfortable in that role.
He's a man of the 1980s.
He really, truly.
On other policy issues too, but yeah. especially there.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I see too the irony of him being the conservative who ends up maybe as a result of historical forces, but also, you know, a lot of contingencies, the one who ultimately shepherds this sentencing reform as his one kind of like big bipartisan accomplishment, I guess now with the exception of the trade deal.
And it's also, well, it's also a signifier of how, you know, for all that Trump, as you say, I think he instinctively wants to sort of be be racially polarizing around issues of crime and urban decay, right? Yeah. Like, that's his instinct.
He loves
but
it.
But the locus of racially inflected anxiety has shifted more from, you know, it shifted from crime to immigration.
Yeah, from cities to the border.
And that's right. And that's sort of, and that's also something that he, I think, sort of intuited. But that's sort of, yeah, and that's why, to my mind, the equivalent of, you know, sort of welfare reform and better policing for our era would be, you know, sort of figuring out a more stable settlement on immigration, which is something he hasn't. I think he is the candidate who, he's the politician who in certain ways would be best positioned to do that, but for all other reasons can't.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you a sort of more meta question while we're in the conservatism writ large part of the episode, which is sort of like analogizing or comparing, I guess. Okay, here's a better way to say it. You have an interesting role in the sort of media economy, writing, you know, to a primarily liberal audience of the New York Times about conservatism, the sort of native informant role. And it's interesting to me because Matt and I are constantly talking both on the podcast and off about what we're trying to do and how we're, because I don't know how much you've listened to the podcast, but it's not like we're doing like...
Ross produces but does not consume podcasts.
Right, that's what I hate. That's what
I hate. I do actually, I don't quite understand how people have time to consume podcasts.
Yeah, no, it's...
No, I will admit I'm not a huge Know Your Enemy listener.
Yeah.
And I apologize.
Well, that's good. Because you have no idea.
I should apologize. No,
I'm just kidding. But because you probably picked up on this, even just having met Matt, that obviously our project is not just like pillaring conservatives and treating them in bad faith and, you know, choosing the least of them to knock down in the way that a lot of like left-wing sort of podcasting and internet owning the cons stuff happens, right? Like we are interested in conservative ideas and that's why we do the podcast, and we're not like compromising our deeply felt left-wing principles. I'm
actually here to pull Matt back. That's why I've been,
and I am aware of that, Ross. And I'm holding onto his shoulder.
We had a meeting. It was me and Deneen and Sorov. And we were like, we don't think we can get Sam, but we can a tug on the thread from Matt Sittman could do a lot of good.
That's my greatest fear. It's my greatest fear. I see this light in his eyes sometimes when we're talking about you know, post liberalism or you know, we're reading Norman Podoritz, and I grab onto his arm and I just have to pull him back from the edge. I just start whispering the beginning of the Communist Manifesto in his ear. But because there's a certain consonance between what we're trying to do and what you do, maybe in some mirrored ways, I'd be interested to hear about how you conceive of your role at the Times.
Yeah, I mean, I think writing about conservatism is in certain ways the strangest part of my job, because it's never quite clear how interested, you know, this, obviously I have lots of conservative readers, but the bulk of the Times' readership tends to be politically liberal. This is not a surprise to anyone. And it's never entirely clear sort of how interested that readership is in sort of inside conservatism. And I mean, what I've found, and probably this is something you guys have found with the podcast, is that the Trump era has made liberals more interested in conservatism than they were before.
Yeah, I think that's
often
right.
often in a sort of panicked and, you know, hysterical way,
yeah.
but in a real way. And certainly I get more interest when I write about, you know, the Sorab Amari David French debate for the Times than I would have 5 years ago writing about, you know, Marco Rubio versus Ted Cruz in the Republican primary.
Yeah.
Right. Like the sort of, you know, there's the horse race of Republican politics is less interesting to, I think, whatever the sort of New York Times reading liberal hive mind is now than than, you know, what the heck is going on the right. Now, and some of that is just like, when do the fascists get here, right? Like a certain kind of anxious liberal reading of conservative writers now is basically just that. It's sort of like, you know, where do we need to find the sentence in this piece that indicates that this person will endorse the fascists when they arrive, if they haven't already arrived, which, you know, which maybe they have. But yeah, I mean, I think my challenge is that I'm trying to sort of participate in these conservative debates at the same time as I'm describing them.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, I guess it's easier, Matt, as Matt knows well, you know, I also do this with Catholicism, where I'm, you know, where I've been more of a participant and more of a controversial participant in sort of Pope Francis era debates. And I think with Trump era debates, because I am this sort of weird hybrid of anti-Trump but pro-populist, it's a little easier for me to sort of lift up and sort of describe in certain ways. Not that I did a good job moderating the Sourav Amari, the French Amari debate. Yeah. I may have had some failures of moderation, but just the fact that I could try.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I just the last podcast I did before recording this, or no, the last podcast I did was our own podcast at the Times, The Argument, which everyone should listen to. But the one before that, I recorded one with Jonah Goldberg, his podcast, The Remnant. And he was accusing me of, you know, not wanting mom and dad to fight, basically. That, you know, I'm trying to, like, keep the different factions of conservatism in conversation with each other.
Are you a child of divorce, Ross?
In fact, I am a child.
That's what everyone keeps telling me about my Bernie and Warren takes, is that it's just all my sublimated child of divorce stuff.
Yeah, and I don't think that's quite right, because I think the fight is really good, and I think the odd thing about the Trump era, normally when you have a Republican president, the politics and policy become more interesting and intellectual and ideological debates become less so. And on the right, that's been reversed under Trump, because there's no real policy in his White House. You know, nothing's happening on Capitol Hill. But the sort of landscape of intellectual conservatism is this fascinating war zone. And that's it's been a very interesting time to write.
Yeah. Well, Ross, I don't want to crib from George Costanza, but I'm a product of my parents staying together.
Oh, boy.
Just throwing that out there. It can be interpreted a number of ways. But, well, speaking of the kind of intra-conservative fights, you say you're pro-populist but anti-Trump, and I get that, especially given your long track record of, well, as you put the Sam's Club Republicanism stuff, you know, I kind of would expect you to carve out that sort of niche. But what do you make of the people who have warmed up to Trump even more? And things like embracing nationalism outright. I kind of raised this question when we were on that panel in D.C. back in November at Georgetown. But it seems like, you know, the position you've carved out shouldn't be that hard to carve out. But I've been disappointed by those on the right who have kind of really leaned into the nationalism stuff and just kind of keep quiet about the worst aspects of it, what we see at the border, the kids in cages, some of which I know started under Obama.
Started under Obama, man.
But see, that's the thing. I don't have to pick on the left. You know, I'm willing to criticize both. But I'm kind of disturbed by leaning into the Trump stuff and the embrace of the nationalism. And I wondered why you think many people who started out very anti-Trump have drifted that way, and where you think it's going. And if I can, I know I've been speaking for a couple minutes, but
keep going.
And I think one way of answering the question that might be a little less speculative would be to say that, well, someone like you, Ross, you have written a book about a more populist, at least economically, conservatism. You know, even the Bush era compassionate conservatism was trying to be a little different than the typical libertarianism. And then, of course, we saw what Trump campaigned on, but it's not clear how much it will stick in the Republican Party. And even people like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio, who are kind of taking up this banner of a more pro-worker economic vision, I'm not really sure what it amounts to. And so we don't need to get into your decadence book now, but the idea of you know, ideological ferment, but actually nothing changing, seems like it might be one possibility. And I just wondered, again, in light of everything going on the right, you know, what people seem to be embracing, will it actually matter, and kind of what's your read on all that?
Yeah, I think those are sort of separate questions, but I can try and relate them. I mean, I'll say this just for myself, right? My biggest concern with Trump was not that he would do, my biggest concern with Trump was that essentially that chaos would be unleashed. Meaning that my colleague Paul Krugman would be right, that when Trump was elected, the stock market would crash, that Trump would become president and immediately Putin would send troops into eastern Ukraine in large numbers, that, you know, that there would be this sort of escalating series of global crises joined to economic disarray, joined to a sort of increase in the trend that was going on while Trump was running for president of domestic terrorist attacks in the U.S. from Islamic jihadist groups, campus protests, sort of 1968 kind of mood. And I think one thing that's just sort of, I think that anxiety was widely shared among never Trumpers. And the reality is that a lot of that stuff hasn't happened. The world has turned out to be more self-stabilizing in spite of Trump's frequent incompetence in foreign policy than I think I expected. Trump has made a lot of bad decisions in foreign policy, but we still have not had, you know, even something on the level of the Libya intervention, which I was strongly against. Certainly nothing on the level of the Iraq war. The American economy has done well, and it hasn't just continued the Obama trend. We actually have like low wage workers are having more wage growth now than they did under Obama. Like it's you know, from that sort of populist perspective, the economy's gotten a little better.
Yeah.
And domestically, I think there's, you know, some of the far right terrorist stuff, I think, is probably linked to Trump's, you know, in some cosmic way, if not a direct causal way, sort of the way Trump sort of, you know, flirts with the Furies, if you will.
For sure.
But there hasn't been, you know, the sort of post-Ferguson riots did not continue. Campuses settled down. Campuses have been remarkably calm, I would say, outside of, a few predictable places.
Or maybe people are just not writing about it, Ross.
I think that's just sort of context, I think, for why I think a lot of people on the right who were never Trump have sort of, you know, found ways to reconcile, because really bad things that they were afraid of haven't happened. And what has happened is, you know, it's obviously just a sort of a continuation of who Trump was on the campaign trail in the White House, this sort of, you know, chaos and demagogy. But I think that's part of the story of sort of what, you know, what you're seeing among conservatives who've become more pro-Trump. And then, you know, and then there's sort of just the work of polarization, right? The Democratic Party has in fact moved to the left somewhat. How much depends on the outcome of the primary, but it has moved to the left. It's certainly moved more to the left on certain social issues, I think, over the last 5 years, which has made it even harder for social and religious conservatives to sort of imagine ourselves in alliance with liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that, yeah, I think that combination explains some of the sort of finding things to like in Trump aspects on the right. That's different from the second question is, you know, the people who are trying to make something out of Trumpism, whether they're the sort of national conservatism intellectuals or Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio in different ways. I mean, I think you can tell a story where the Republican Party and conservatism in the modern era often sort of end up moving back towards the center after a period of sort of libertarian purity, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the Reagan administration was not just an exercise in implementing all of Milton Friedman's policy priorities.
Right. Certainly
people
not.
Can write, you know, Henry Olson has written a whole book about Reagan as sort of a working class conservative, which is not, I think, is sort of overstated, but it's, you know, it's an actual part of the history. You have something similar, you know, there are aspects of the Contract with America is not a sort of document of libertarian purity. Compassionate conservatism is obviously a very conscious attempt to claim a sort of center-right but centrist economic vision. And it just happened, and it's happened again, it's just happened in this totally bizarre way, right? Where, you know, Trump sort of just, you know, he dropped a lot of Paul Ryan's agenda. And some of it has sort of crept back in around the edges in things the Trump administration does. But the sort of big picture stuff we associated with the Tea Party era has just sort of dropped off the map. And, you know, I mean, Trump is like a loose money conservative, right? Which, I, you know, is that alone is a notable shift. He's a cynical loose money conservative who wants to appoint people to the Fed who are only loose money conservatives because they like mm-hmm. him. But I mean that it's not, I write columns and I believe this, that like there were aspects of Trump's populism that he sort of abandoned or hasn't tried to implement. Right. And that's real. He did sort of let Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan run his agenda for the first year or so.
Yeah.
But at the macro level, you know, a sort of conservative who just, you know, leaves the economy alone and pushes for a loose monetary policy is more populist than Tea Party era conservatism. Mm-hmm. So that's real. Whether you can go beyond, I mean, I think what I want and what, you know, what Grand New Party wanted way back, what sort of the world of like American affairs and these people want now is something that's one step beyond that. That's like not just a conservatism that tacks towards the center, but a conservatism that has sort of a specific affirmative economic policy vision of how you're going to, you know, rebuild the working and middle classes in the US. Mm-hmm. And that's harder to get to. And it's harder to get to, I think, for reasons, I think the left-wing narrative about why it's hard to get to is partially plausible, right? Like people on the left would say, well, you can't get there because you need unions as a base of support for that.
Yeah.
And conservatives don't like unions. And this is, I think, the big question in part with all the sort of nationalist and populist forays is where does the institutional support come from? Where does the money come from? Where do the donors come from? I know people who are in Republican politics who are trying to like build networks of donors for populism. And it's just a lot harder than building a network of donors for
why could that be?
Yeah, it's a mystery.
Baffling.
This is also like at the larger level, I mean, I co-taught a course on conservatism at Yale Law like almost 2 years ago now, where we sort of went back into the 19th century and tried to sort of link up American conservatism and British conservatism. And, you know, British conservatism had it had sort of institutional bases in a landed aristocracy, an established church, you know, things that have all sort of gone away at this point or disappeared. But it had these sort of institutional bases. And American conservatism has only had, you know, industrialists, right? And I think the hope that some of us who are socially conservative has always been is that, you know, sort of that the institutions, the platoons of the religious right could be used as a basis for a pro-family populism. But the religious right has weakened in all kinds of ways too. I don't have a sort of definite optimism about how Josh Hawley is going to be president in 10 years and we're going to be implementing, pro-family and conservative industrial policy or something. I think it's totally possible that Bernie or even Biden gets elected and, you know, the Republicans move back to the right on economics. And then you could just sort of continue this slightly decadent, if you will, you know, movement back and forth between libertarianism out of power and slightly more center-right policy in power.
So I'm gonna press you and propose sort of a problem that you might not disagree with. But, you know, one of the things that I glean from your work that you'd like to be able to do is separate this useful corrective to a certain libertarian American exceptionalist vision of nationalism and populism from the really ugly nativist part of it, right? Like Trumpism without Trump. Not that you would support that, but that's a pithy way of describing what I'm talking about. But so
there's a version of Trumpism without Trump,
right,
that I would,
right. Yeah. And so what I'm going to propose is that there's a problem with that, which is that possibly what works about Trumpism is both parts. Is that in order to have a constituency of white Americans, white older Americans, especially white American men, who are supporters of, are a constituency for some brought more redistributive, more populist policy, you also need this new and narrowing concept of what the national community consists of. Like you're probably familiar with the critique that I'm saying.
I've heard it a few times. Yeah.
So that is often my instinct. I think, yeah, okay, like I like loose monetary policy. I even like some of the family policy that is being proposed. And I even am more sympathetic to the, you know, revival of the two income trap kind of family policy. But as far as this imagined Republican Party that's oriented around populist economics, but that is isolated from, that quarantines itself from the ugliest versions of the Trumpist nationalist impulses, maybe that doesn't work.
Yeah, I think
because the vilification of the other, of the marginal racial identities and the immigrants, is what gives them license to say, we're all Americans, we can support each other, let's bring this thing together and help each other out.
I think that's totally possible. You know, I think it would be foolish for anyone who has lived through the rise of Trump to sort of say, oh, it's easy to, you know, it's easy to separate populism from nativism. It's obviously, if it were easy, the two would not be so tightly conjoined, right? And we have a larger history that I don't think is repeating itself, but I think there are echoes of cultural and social conservatism ending up in alliances with nationalism. You know, the story of early 20th century politics, right, is a story of not always and everywhere, but of cultural conservatives figuring that they could, you know, sort of make successful alliances with nationalists against the menace of communism or just liberalism, and ending up, you know, with the nationalists in charge and often very bad things happening. So I think it would be, I don't think we're headed for that kind of place again, but I think there are, you know, there are sort of echoes and recursions in history.
Yeah. Morbid symptoms in the interregnum?
That are real. Morbid symptoms, right. Well, this is, yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of, you know, a, not first as tragedy, then as farce, but something along those lines, element, certain aspects of our politics, and not only on the right. With that being said, I also think that, put it this way, I think that politics, you know, we're going to get back to Schmidt, of course, but like politics has, you're never not going to have an other in your politics.
Yeah, an us and a them.
You're never not going to have an enemy, right? And the trick is to make it be the right enemy, right? And so, you know, the conservatism that I have in mind, that, you know, the Trumpism without Trump and so on, would still have enemies. And, you know, you can see how, you know, when Josh Hawley gives a speech and attacks cosmopolitanism or something, right? Like those, you know, the sort of idea of like upper class social liberals as the enemy, mm-hmm, will be reacted to on the left as, you know, this is right wing anti-Semitism come again, which I don't think it is. And that would be a much longer conversation. But like, you know, George W. Bush had a much more deracialized, yeah, conservatism, but it was a religious conservatism that inspired lots of people to, you know, accuse him of setting up a theocracy.
Right.
So the question is not whether conservatism has an other or has an enemy. The question is whether it can get away from a place where, like, you know, the descendants of slaves and immigrants are seen as the other, and get to a point where instead it's just, you know, just Upper West Side liberals again, as as it should be. Right?
It would be preferable to us too.
I don't think that's at all impossible. And I think to go back to the point I was making about the moral and strategic, right? I think that there is power in linking this sort of populism to white identity politics, but it's also self-limiting in ways that politicians should be able to respond to and react to and adapt to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that, and I also think you don't have a ton of evidence that, like, this stuff always works for Trump, right? Like in the 2018 midterms, Trump went hard on, you know, the border caravans and, you know, sort of racial dog whistles in the run up to the election, and he didn't do well, and he didn't do well in ways that cost him some of those populist voters that he had won in 2016, who may return to him in 2020, obviously. But but it's not the case that there's some sort of perfect magic in race baiting. And in fact, lots of things Trump does around race are just flat out unpopular with his own voters. You know, not with all of them. There's a segment that are activated by him. But it's not like people are, you know, it's not like every Obama Trump voter is in love with Trump's Twitter feed. Exactly. Right. Right? Yeah. I mean, reality and human beings are more complicated than that.
Yes.
So
yeah.
So I do think that you're going to have, you know, a Trumpism without Trump would be well to the right of where you guys are in immigration.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a reality, right? Like it would not be, you know, excited about affirmative action, or maybe it would have a take on affirmative action that was sort of built on
socioeconomic affirmative action.
Well, or was trying to fragment the Democratic coalition by saying we should have affirmative action for the descendants of slaves and not for other immigrant groups, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of different ways coalitions can fragment and things can be attacked and so on. But I don't think it's impossible to imagine a populism that had as its other different groups and less vulnerable groups than the groups that are sort of the other when Trump is,
right,
you know, is talking about separating families and children at the border or something.
Maybe the question I have will combine some of what we've been talking about with your book. And that's, you know, one thing we try to do on the show is be critical of the left sometimes, sometimes by looking at the right. It's kind of lessons you can learn. But I think one question along those lines I have that maybe you're in a good position to answer is that when we think of the populist insurgencies the last few years, whether it's Trump or Brexit and Boris Johnson or, you know, Orban and Hungary and things like that, you know, the left has a certain story. It's neoliberalism, it's austerity, and especially in the US where we don't have the kinds of welfare states they might have in Scandinavia or Northern Europe, you say, well, you know, we could have blunted Trump's, a certain economic populism, a more robust economic message might kind of thwart Trump's more racially populist.
In other words, Bernie would have won.
Yeah, in other words, Bernie would have won. But
right. But
I think, you know, there are lots of reasons Jeremy Corbyn lost. And I don't like the comparisons between Corbyn and Sanders that sometimes got made. But what are the limits of the left's economic view of why we have the political situations we have now?
Good question.
And maybe especially as a conservative and a religious conservative, there are, you know, matters of the spirit that might be involved, or, you know, kind of, you know, something that simply economics can't address. And maybe that's something, you know, that can lead into discussion of your book too.
Yeah. So one, I mean, I think there are two limits to the left's view of this, right? One is something that you already gestured at, which is the reality that populism is a problem and an issue across a very wide range of not just Western, but we can just stick with Western societies, right?
Sure.
And it's, you know, and it happened to take power in a way in the US for sort of reasons that are contingent to our two-party system and the Electoral College and so on. But it's not clear that it's that much more potent in the US than it is in, you know, some very socially democratic parts of Europe, right? I mean, if you look at sort of how far to the right the Danes have moved on issues of immigration and assimilation,
yeah,
right? Like Denmark, if the Trump administration proposed some of the, you know, certain Danish policies around assimilation, they would be viewed as sort of, you know, horrifyingly right-wing and racist,
yes,
right? And, yeah. And this is sort of, you know, that's less true in Sweden, but even Sweden has moved to the right as well.
For sure.
And so that alone suggests that while there is clearly an economic component to this story, and I'm more, you know, I'm more on the side of the people who want to talk about economics and the people who want to say it's just all about race, clearly there's something more going on than just, you know, we need a more Scandinavian welfare state, right? In yeah. current anxieties and disappointments. And some of that might be a different economic story, right? You can tell a story where the sort of left, which I think is partially true, where the sort of left-wing welfare state policies are fine for sort of, you know, dealing with the worst forms of poverty, but struggle to figure out what you do with a working class that, you know, feels itself to be economically obsolete, right? Mm-hmm. Like just sort of, I mean, there's clearly a strong component in American politics of people who feel themselves to be in economic trouble, but don't respond well to a Democratic Party that says, don't worry, we'll just, you know, take care of you with stronger welfare spending. They want, you know, sort of jobs and self-sufficiency and these kind of things.
Or don't worry, we'll teach you to code.
Don't right, exactly. The coding idea, right, is like people, you know, there's that doesn't answer it. But that's one limit, I think, that the left has to figure out its way through. That the current just saying we need to be more like Europe is not a full-scale answer at all. And then the other limit is that, you know, and you, I think you see this with Corbyn, you see this in U.S. politics too, you know, the golden age of the left, such as it was an era when not all, but some left of center politics were closely associated with things that we think of now as social conservatism, right? With, you know, sort of religious and culturally conservative folkways. Some of which don't exist anymore and have dissolved, but were real, some of which still do exist. And there is a basic, I think, alienation between how a lot of working class people, not only white working class people, look at the world and the sort of cultural narratives and cultural language and cultural analysis that prevails at sort of the upper reaches of liberal thought. And what that means is that in political terms, right, there is sort of a choice, a more populist left to be more successful, I think, would need to at least send signals that it's not, you know, just Judith Butler's worldview given political flesh, right? And this is something I think Bernie does pretty well, which is part of why there's such a difference between his base of support and Elizabeth Warren's. Or alternatively, you know, if what we think of as sort of, you know, elite cultural liberal discourse is just sort of essential and morally necessary and correct and true in every way, then you might have to accept that you're not going to be that the left is not going to be as working class as it used to be, and that it is going to be a sort of more upper middle class formation, and you are going to need to win those Hillary voting suburbanites and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a resistance to that choice among people on the center left, right? There's a desire to say we can have our Judith Butler and get the steelworkers to vote for us too. Mm-hmm. Not that people would say it in those terms, but I think that's real. And I think that's a problem. That's sort of a limiting force on the progress of, and the success of both, you know, both left-wing and sort of conventionally liberal political parties and movements right now.
Well, we don't need to get into all that.
We can do, I'll come back for a special Judith Butler and Foucault episode, right?
Yeah. So your book, Ross, is called...
The Decadent Society.
The Decadent Society, How We Became a Victim of Our Own Success. And it did strike me that, like Patrick Deneen's book, which says that liberalism, its failure is because of its success, that this is a... Is this a conservative way of... a particularly conservative way of doing analysis? Looking for those almost ironic, that wasn't even a mean question. That was me just kind of, I noticed the resonance. And what is it about the conservative mind that looks for those kind of ironies? And
yeah, I mean, it's undoubtedly the case that the conservative mind is always on the lookout for how sort of what seems like development and transformation and reform will ultimately lead to stagnation and disaster. I think what is distinguishes my argument a little bit from some other conservative arguments mm-hmm. is that it lays a heavier emphasis on stagnation, drift, and repetition than it does on sort of looming catastrophe. And that sort of, I think, informs mm-hmm. some of the political analysis that I've just offered, right, is yeah. itself premised on the assumption that we're actually not about to sort of descend into the Marxist gulag or the fascist nightmare. And one reason that I can sort of write sympathetically about both Bernie Sanders and Tucker Carlson in this moment is that my assumption is that the gulag and the Reich are not imminent. And they're not imminent because I think the defining feature of our age is this kind of stasis and repetition, where mm-hmm. it's very hard for sort of institutions and movements and individuals to sort of achieve what feels like forward momentum and progress. And I think this is sort of, I think, kind of a conventional take when it comes to politics. Yeah. I think it's sort of uncontroversial, mm-hmm. right? That sort of gridlock and sclerosis are the order of the day, and that we have these deadlocks that, in part in the US are a feature of our constitutional system, but show up in different ways in different systems. Brexit may have finally had its breakthrough, but it's been a perfect example of gridlock and chaos for several mm-hmm. years now.
Yeah.
The relationship between the EU's center and its periphery. Anyway, it's very easy to sort of see that in politics. And I think what I try and do in the book, maybe persuasively, maybe not, is link that to a bunch of other areas, to demography and declining birth rates and the aging of our society. I think aging mm-hmm. societies are more likely to sort of end up in these patterns of drift and repetition and stasis. I link it to the argument that you get from everyone from Robert Gordon and Tyler Cowen to sure. David Graeber, to pick a more left-wing example, that we've had much less technological progress in the developed world over the last couple generations than people think. And
yeah.
that's more contentious and it's a little harder to be certain about that, but I think it's broadly true. Mm-hmm. At the very least, we've clearly had outsized progress in technologies of simulation and communication yeah. relative to progress everywhere
yeah.
else.
Yeah. Our ability to experience events is quickened in our...
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then finally, I have a cultural piece, which is totally unprovable, but I think somewhat persuasive, which is that in the arts, the movies, pop culture, that something similar is happening, and something like this makes something like the trajectory of the Star Wars saga a perfect example of yeah. what decadence, in my definition, means. That yeah. the prequels are not actually decadent. They're bad movies, mm-hmm. but they're movies in which Lucas is trying and failing to do something new. Mm-hmm. And out of that failure comes the latest trilogy, where it's just, no, we're just going to repeat the movies we made 40 years ago. And that's what decadence is. You try and get out, it doesn't work, and then you just go back to doing the same things again at a high level of technological proficiency, right? Amazing special effects and so yeah. on. But that's the rough argument. And yeah. it does make me, it's more pessimistic in certain ways than a lot of people, because I'm sort of assuming that it's really hard to change things.
Yeah.
But it's more sanguine in other ways, because I'm assuming it's really hard to change things.
Yeah. No, I think in that sense, it's a very Douthat esque book because it there is a kind
well,
of
one would hope.
Yes,
I mean
no, but it, I mean it. It's very reflective. I think it does. Maybe a better way of putting it would be that it does make sense of I think of some of your more occasional punditry to get this more comprehensive view of how you view things. But it does. It's lacking the apocalyptic element that I think you sometimes get with someone like Patrick Deneen, or some of the more, you know, the integralist types on the right who you can tell they're really, maybe they think some breakthrough is possible, or at least they're play acting that way.
Yeah, I think there's an assumption of
things could break.
Yeah, I guess I'm agnostic to skeptical about the idea of the crisis of the liberal order. Like, yeah. I really like arguing about it. Mm-hmm. I think there is a sense in which we're in a crisis of the liberal mm-hmm. order, but we're also like sitting around writing about it from coffee shops, know, which right? yeah. is maybe not what the real crisis of the liberal order yeah. would look like. I don't know.
Yeah, but I did, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you was, you begin your book by talking about kind of man going to the moon, right? And the 60s being this last era of kind of us having a frontier. Right, someplace new to go to, new exploration to do, a sense that there were new possibilities we were pushing toward. And you can contrast that now with the kind of stasis we're in. But from a conservative perspective, why do you, you know, isn't it good not to have new boundaries you're pushing, new frontiers to explore? It seems that view seems to be based on kind of movement and progress and some forward whatever that, you know, isn't stasis and repetition good from the conservative point of view?
Yeah, and this is where, you know, to come back since we started this conversation with you asking me, you know, why uh-huh. I am or if I am a conservative, there are ways in which this is not a fully conservative book. I mean, uh-huh. I think my basic view would be that there are a lot of different forms of a good society, and you can have a uh-huh. good society that is very conservative in the sense you're just sort of describing, that is sort of rooted in mm-hmm. you know, tradition and intergenerational transmission, and that's not a bad form for society to take. Mm-hmm. It's pretty and that is, I think, if you know, if you get to the end of Patrick Deneen's book, or you get, you know, more fully in Rod Dreher's The Benedict Option, you know, that I think is a it's a reasonable conservative response to the decadence that I'm describing, to say, well, we need to sort of restore these kind of communities, and we have to, you know, maybe we have to play act them at first or invent them at mm-hmm. first. But mm-hmm. even if we're inventing a tradition, it's still better than, you know, sort of having no traditions at all and just watching Marvel movies forever.
Yeah. While smoking pot.
And right. And I don't, and yeah, yeah. And so I don't, I have sympathies for that, with that view, but it's not, I think, the only, it's not the only positive way to order a society. And there are good things about societies that are more sort of dynamic and inventive. And I don't think, and I say this at the end of the book, I don't think there obviously are tensions between sort of ideologies of science and, you know, my own Roman Catholicism, right? Mm-hmm. Like those tensions exist. At the same time, I don't think there's a necessary tension between the religious impulse and the scientific impulse.
Right.
This sort of mm-hmm. desire for knowledge about the universe, this desire, this belief that like there are orders that we can encounter and discern, there are higher powers that we can encounter and so on.
Yeah. Neil deGrasse Tyson is a religious figure.
Well, but that's right. But that's like debates, right? Like that's nobody. DeGrasse Tyson is like
a religious figure of in decadent times.
Well, you know, the whole like I bleeping love science, right? It's not, that's not what actual science is. I think actual science is
often he's a bore.
Weirder.
He's a bore.
And but yeah, just like the idea that sort of, you know, the I guess I am in a sense sort of gesturing at a version of a different kind of fusionism,
yeah,
right? Like not the fusionism of Grover Norquist and Pat Robertson in a coalition together, but a fusionism that says, you know, it's possible to think that what the Catholic Church believes and teaches is true, and also think that we should go to Mars, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't think that that's, you know, the fusionism that's likely to sweep the world, but it might weirdly be the fusionism that we need.
Yeah. So I hadn't read your column on the 2010s, the decade of disillusionment, until yesterday. And I know that this relates to the book, I imagine, but I found that your periodization in that column was really interesting and helpful with the 1990s age of hubris, where we thought the end of history was upon us and, you know, the liberal order was stable and going to spread its good tidings across the world via the welcoming of our democratic armies into their countries, et cetera, et cetera. And then the era of the 2000s was the nemesis era in the inevitable realities striking down hope. You reference the Kipling poem "Return of the Gods of the Copybook Headings," which is a great poem. And and then the 2010s was the age of disillusionment, which is to say that there's a sense of crisis and alienation. This is quoting you. And betrayal, it emerged from backward glances, looking back at the disasters of the past and reckoning with them, or at least being awoken to their having happened, which I thought was really a helpful way to make sense of the past decade, in which it feels like everything happened, and yet when you actually look at the figures, look at the events, much less happened than in the decades before. And the idea that what we're seeing is sort of a reckoning with the worst, with the excesses or the misdeeds of the past, or an awareness of them, which like prefigures some kind of reckoning, that is compelling to me. I see like this moment where Trump could win again or Bernie could win as sort of like different sorts of answers to the reckoning of the 2010s.
Yeah, I think that's roughly what I was arguing, except that because I believe in decadence, I'm skeptical that
it will happen. Anything will happen.
Bernie. Well, I think Trump was sort of a first reckoning, right? That Trump, you know, if you think of like the big things that happened from from the late 90s through the 2008 financial crisis, right? It's, you know, it's a certain kind of deregulation. It's the opening to China.
Yeah.
It's the Iraq war and the war on terror and then the financial crisis.
Yes.
And Trump represents a partial reckoning with that on the right.
Yeah.
It's like, what does the right make of all these things that many conservative politicians supported that did not end well?
Yeah.
And so if Bernie actually gets the nomination, or Warren to some extent, I don't want to slight her partial radicalism. I know you're trying to keep the family together, Sam.
I am. Yeah. Thank you.
And, home for the holidays. I think that would represent a partial reckoning on the left. And then you would have sort of more compelling right-wing and left-wing narratives about what went wrong than you had when Romney was running against Obama.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I mean, I started working on the book about decadence then, and after 2012, and various things intervened. I got sick, and I had to write a book about the Pope, God help me. And
you had so to, then, Ross? You had to?
Maybe I didn't. Maybe. Judging by its sales, maybe I didn't after all. And so that, to me, was in certain ways, that election, Romney-Obama, was more decadent than Trump-Bernie would be.
Yeah.
In the sense that Romney and Obama, it's like we're not reckoning with anything. We're just returning an incumbent to power and putting up a sort of, you know, a Bain finance guy against him.
Yeah.
And nothing's going to happen and nothing's going to change. And now we're in a moment where, no, there is a reckoning and there are ideological currents. History is creeping back in, mm-hmm. and it makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so in that sense, you know, I wrote a column way back where I said that, you know, Trump and Bernie were both in 2016 were sort of revolts against decadence, revolts against the idea that this is the best we can do. Make America great again is, you know, it's reactionary futurism, right?
Yeah.
It's the idea that there's a past that could be linked to a better future, and Bernie's is doing something similar on the left. Yeah. I'm just skeptical, and we will find out in the Sanders presidency, if I'm right, that that's enough to sort of get us through the structural forces that make us decadent and make it hard to do anything big or change anything dramatically. And certainly, I think a second Trump, I think Trump's presidency has mostly vindicated the idea that you can elect, you know, a slightly insane seeming, you know, demagogue. And in fact, not that much, not that much will change. And maybe Bernie will be different. But my basic view is that I think we're at least a generational. I think there might be a crisis of liberalism, a real one this century, but I would bet on it still for like 2050 rather than, I think this is more the dress rehearsal, but I'll be proven wrong happily or unhappily.
Well, your book comes out when? February next month.
February 25th. So right. This is a, your readers who want to really, really know their enemies should pre-order it right now.
And as I mentioned, I did read most of it. I skimmed some because, I just wanted to get through it all.
Some parts are skimmable.
But it was, I just want to say for our left-wing readers, they'll enjoy the digs at Billy McFarland and Fire Festival, Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, Uber, you know, there's a lot they'll like in the book. And I did find too, that it pointed things out that once I read it, I was like, oh yeah, that's definitely true. Like the sense that we're always just waiting for the next thing to happen. Like you mentioned, a new study showed we might be able to cure this disease or that disease, or, you know, this new development is just around the corner and that will change everything. But we keep waiting for them. They're not actually happening. We're not actually finding cures for, you know, some of these big diseases. And we're not actually, these new developments aren't actually happening the way you might think. And the things we do think of as big developments, like the tech sector and whatnot, are actually less, in some ways, less revolutionary than we might think.
And I appreciated, and I already referenced it, but that one of your epigraphs was Antonio Gramsci, and
that's a crypto endorsement of Pete Buttigieg.
I was gonna say when I saw it, I went back and I opened my actual copy of the Prison Notebooks translated by none other than Joseph Buttigieg, and found the line in it because I was like, which, you know, everyone quotes that all the time. Not that it's an excellent epigraph for your book, I think, but
he was talking about a very different era.
He was talking about a very different era, but it is. It was 1930, but you know, in retrospect, there were about to be quite a lot of morbid symptoms. I'll read it so people know what I'm talking about. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear, and that's from Antonio Gramsci, The Prison Notebooks. I do think that. This idea of being in between or stuck or waiting, from my perspective, that in some ways there is a crisis of some sort of order, whether it's the liberal order or sort of a libertarian certainty about capitalism, is dying. But it is true that we aren't really in the moment where the new is being born. And I also thought that you were bringing up the possibility that there's a lot of Marxists and fascists on the internet, but are like how much Marxism and fascism is actually happening in the world, and how much of it is digital play acting amongst young people who are dissatisfied with the decadence, but the actual stuff of it isn't happening. Like you say, more memes than street fights, and so I identify with it. Hopefully, there'll from my perspective, more Marxism, less fascism in the next decade.
This is a quote from the book. If you want to feel like Western society is convulsing, there's an app for that, a convincing simulation waiting. But in the real world, it's possible that Western society is really leaning back in an easy chair, hooked up to a drip of something soothing, playing and replaying an ideological greatest hits tape from its wild and crazy youth, all riled up in its own imagination, and yet, in reality, comfortably numb.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does sound horribly like me.
You sound like yourself.
Yeah.
That's the goal of a writer.
That's right. With time, you will eventually become the perfect incarnation of it.
Well, next month, we'll be sure to, I'm sure I'll be tweeting about your book, and I mentioned Andrew Bacevich is reviewing it for Commonwealth, so I'm not sure I'll write about it, but I might try. But so everyone listening should definitely buy The Decadent Society out next month. Yeah. And thank you, Ross, for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
It's been great.
You're very welcome. I hope that you're listening.
Was it painful to be in the enemy chair?
No, you guys were actually, in fact, way too kind, and you need to become harsher. You need to read more Schmidt to pump yourself up before these podcasts.
Of course, the irony of it is that we are the worst Schmidtians on the left. We have this podcast that's called Know Your Enemy, and some old friends of Matt have been really upset about that. But we're total wimps.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, and Matt, I'll be sending you some literature off podcast.
I'm going to hack.
Continue the reconversion.
Sure. Oh my God.
There's this hot new book co-written by the Pope Emeritus. I don't know if you've gotten that yet. All right. Anyway, thank you guys. This was
thanks, Ross.
Thank you, Ross.
All right. Take care.
Sunlight.